title of this sermon, Wait and See. And I want to be sure to say up front that it's not the old wait and see. Well, I'll just sit and wait and see what happens. It's an active waiting. Seeing enables doing. Waiting. So much of life is waiting. Waiting to see what grade you got on the test. Waiting to see if you get accepted at college. Waiting to see if you get the job. Waiting to see if he loves you. If she says yes. Waiting for the baby to come. Waiting at the window, pacing for a teenager to get home safely. Waiting to see what the kids are going to do. Waiting until you can retire and finally begin to enjoy life. Waiting to see if the surgery went well. Waiting to see if the brokenness can be repaired. Sometimes you begin to think that all of life is just waiting. And then one day, if you're lucky or wise, or maybe a little bit of both, you realize that it's in the waiting that life is lived. You wait for your children to grow up. And then you realize that it's in the waiting that you had the amazing feeling of a tiny hand reaching up and grasping yours as you walked along. It's in the waiting that you heard their giggles, that you laughed with their laughter, that you were moved to tears of joy and fear. And that's living. You live together, having to concentrate on work and getting the kids through all the stages of growing. And then you keep working after the kids are gone, and you wait for that day to come when you will have more time together to enjoy the things you want to do, to finally live. And you forget that it's in the waiting that all your living is really taking place. And if your eyes are fixed way down the road to the day when the waiting to live may be over, you'll miss seeing all the little joys that are yours right now, all the love that's lying there, waiting to be embraced, the real living that's captured even in the middle of the dailiness, the sadness, or the fear of a moment. Don't misunderstand. I take seriously the pain-filled, fear-filled, sometimes tragic waiting times. They are real. And they are not lessened by well-meaning platitudes about God's plan to teach or to give strength or some other unfathomable reason, by saying there's some kind of grand plan behind it to tell us who's there, what's there, why there is the tragedy. There are people who want someone to be in control, something to be in control, to have a reason why this tragedy occurs, why the dark moments are there. They want some intent behind it all. Can't entertain the thought that the hard moments of waiting might just be a part of living, the living out of life in this world. That life sometimes goes well and sometimes doesn't. There are bugs and germs and viruses and cells that for whatever reason just run wild. There is gravity and there are loose steps and there is too much speed. There is human foolishness and there is downright meanness. These things are there. We can't pretend they aren't there or somehow disguise them behind religious bromides intending to comfort us, but that instead blind us, keep us from seeing who and what is around us, who and what can be, even in the hard moments. If in waiting we see, we may glimpse around the painful, ugly things that are a part of life in this world, that hard as it is sometimes to see, that around those there is joy unspeakable, love indescribable, breathtaking beauty, laughter warm and riotous. In fact, knowing that these kinds of things are there in life are also a part of what makes the tragic moments so tragic. Life is such a mixture, and often, always, unpredictable. Wait and see. In Green Winter, A Celebration of Age, Elise Macaulay writes, as an older woman, knowing that the end is finally death, but she doesn't just wait for death. She begins to use the waiting to see, to become a presence for those who need one. She uses the waiting time to think about what she's going to do with what she has. And so she gives life to her waiting. I'm giving away my things, and it turns out to be as much of an occupation and as much fun as collecting them was. I browse among my friends the way I used to browse in shops. I try to decide who should have the cameo I wore as a bride, who would like my Chinese vase. I go through closets and drawers, and I am amazed at what I find, so many objects. I am ashamed to have so much when so many have so little. Worse still, there are a lot of things I hardly ever use. This hammered fish poacher, for example. Handsome, hammered copper. It came from France. I used it once or twice. We thought a meal had to be meat and potatoes. The kids know better. My daughter-in-law, Jill, eats only vegetables and fish. She says it saves grain for the hungry and is a less aggressive way. She'll love this poacher and my silver napkin rings. She won't use paper napkins. She says she wants no tree to die to wipe her mouth. It takes forever sorting things. I stop to think about where and when, and I find myself thinking, I may have use for this again. Nonsense. I don't bake angel food cakes anymore. Give the pan away. Funny, I thought I'd feel a sense of loss with fewer of my things around. I don't. I feel exhilarated, free. Is this why Jesus told the rich man to sell his goods? I think now the commandment was meant to help the rich man more. Waiting. In waiting, we tell stories. Rule books, owner's manuals, doctrinal creeds, philosophical tomes can't grasp us in the waiting moments. It is stories that can connect us with living. Stories can seize the imagination, captivate it, and enter our memories to help form who we are and how we act. That's why biblical stories, and I teach the Hebrew Bible stories a lot, biblical stories, if you read them as stories, not as part of a game of life rule book or roadmap to heaven, can give us an awareness that is rich in detail and messiness of the real people living real lives right in the middle of waiting. The old Hebrews understood that. They told a story of a people waiting in slavery in Egypt and of a movement toward freedom. The truth of that story doesn't depend on referential, empirically verifiable facts, but by the profound truth that the human desire, individually and communally, is for control over our own lives. The story they told so resonated across cultures and ages that nearly 2,000 years after its shaping, African Americans waiting in slavery and later chafing under the oppression of racial discrimination walk down the street singing the line from that old story, "Let my people go." It's a story that speaks profoundly not only to groups, but to individuals, to genders, who sit in fear of the psychological and physical power of other persons. The story says, you are not forgotten. Your suffering is not unnoticed. Those old Hebrews told the story of 587, a date that lived in infamy for them as Pearl Harbor does for many Americans. The date their nation fell apart and they found themselves waiting in exile under the thumb of a foreign power. The story raised the question we often ask in our waiting, what's happening to us? And in answer it says, in your waiting, you are not alone. Later, the early Jewish followers of Rabbi Jesus, another Jew living under the tyranny of another foreign power, told stories of a man who had a vision for the creation of a different kind of world where every person, friend or enemy, would be living in a society shaped not by raw power but by the presence of caring, would have the opportunity to achieve their potential. Their stories told of a kind of presence in life that also said, you are not forgotten. Your suffering is noticed. Some people might label that as the presence of God, but most often I think it's the presence of another human being. A seminary professor captured it in a story of his own life. He told of his father's funeral. His father had been a Presbyterian minister. The family went back to the little church in Louisiana for the funeral for his father. He said he saw a lot of people who had known his father, remembered him, told them stories about him. A man came up to him, a man who had been a janitor in the church when his father was there and moved away and came back for the funeral. And he came up to Don and said, you know, your dad was very special to me. Don said, I said, oh, I know, Leon, you were very important to him. But Leon knew a dismissal when he saw one. So he said, no, I don't think you understand. I don't think I would be here today if it were not for your dad. I would not have made it through that horrible night. What do you mean? During the time your dad was pastor in this church and he and I worked together, you probably don't remember this because you were a little boy, but my wife died suddenly. She was only 34 years old. She was hanging clothes out on the line. She had a massive heart attack. She didn't even make it to the hospital alive. We had four little kids. I will never forget that day. I was devastated. I was so emotionally drained that evening, I just fell across the bed. I remember lying in the bed, and it had gotten dark. And I looked up at one point, and I could see that your dad had come into the room and was sitting in a rocking chair beside my bed. He just sat there rocking. All night long, I would wake up and I would reach over to where my wife usually was, and I would feel the emptiness and the pain would shoot through me like 1,000 arrows. I wondered how in the world I could go on. And then out of the corner of my eye, I would see him rocking, rocking. It was the rocking that helped me make it through the night. The story catches what I mean when I talk about seeing in the waiting, to sense a presence, to become a presence. Sometimes in our lives, the presence doesn't seem like much, hardly noticeable, like a man rocking in a dark corner. No easy answers spoken, just a presence. It comes by and for us as individuals. But it's also a communal experience, a societal experience. Sometimes there will be a group of people who can show us clearly what it means to see in the waiting, who show us that it is possible to be a real presence when the darkness closes in. when religious platitudes and easily quoted Bible verses are cheap and out of touch and of little help in the struggle and the waiting. Years ago, I discovered such a group when in one of those serendipitous moments, I picked up a used book and was seized by the story of Le Chambon, a little village in rural France, where a simple rural people, taking great risks, lived out the call of their faith to love the alien, to feed the hungry, to care for the suffering, to protect the persecuted. They lived out the understanding of their pastor, who said the main distinction between people in this world is between those who believe that people in need are as precious as they themselves are, and those who don't believe that. This little village and the area around it hid and protected and saved more than 5,000 Jews seeking shelter from the Nazi Holocaust and from the French government that had agreed to turn over Jews for deportation. These people opened their homes, their schools, constructed shelters, shared their meager supplies. Why did they do it? Partly because they never forgot that their roots were in people who had been refugees. They were Huguenots, French Protestants whose ancestors in the 1500s converted to Protestantism. Their ancestors were tortured, denied civil rights, forced to make conversions back to Catholicism. They fled to the mountains for refuge. Even there, they were hunted, their churches were burned, their pastors murdered. In the 1940s, these rural people remembered what their ancestors had endured, remembered the faith values their ancestors had taught, trying to live the religion of Jesus, not a religion about Jesus. The totality of their lives they shared with anyone who came. Don't be afraid of strangers. Reach out to others and welcome all who come. In my study of this community, I discovered an amazing thing, really amazing. During the French Revolution, the Reign of Terror, when priests and bishops in the Roman Catholic Church were being hunted, targeted for torture and death, these Protestants on the plateau offered refuge to any priest who came to their door. Priests from the same church that had hunted their ancestors. When the Vichy government agreed to a treaty to hand over Jews to the Germans, to the Nazis, their pastor, André Trocmé, whose picture you saw earlier, preached a sermon telling members they should resist and how they should resist government demands. Tremendous pressure, he said, will be brought on us to submit passively to a totalitarian ideology. If they don't succeed in subjugating our souls, they will want to subjugate our bodies. The duty of Christians is to use the weapons of the Spirit to oppose the violence they will try to put on our consciences. We appeal to all to refuse to cooperate with this violence. He said, loving and forgiving and doing good to our adversaries is our duty, yet we must do this without giving up, without being cowardly. We shall resist whenever our adversaries demand of us obedience contrary to the orders of the gospel. We shall do this without fear, but also without pride and without hate. Their providing refuge started with a knock on the door of the presbytery, the minister's residence, when a woman said to the minister's wife, Magda, I am Jewish, can you help me? Magda's simple response, of course, come in, set the whole community in motion. During 4 years, no Chambonnet ever turned away a refugee, and no Chambonnet ever denounced a refugee, a community of 5,000. When Daniel Trocmé, the pastor's cousin, a gifted teacher, was invited to come to Le Chambon, and set up the first school opened specifically for Jewish refugee boys, his parents were afraid of the danger for their son. In a letter, he told them that he felt he had to do this so that in the future he would not have to look back and be ashamed. Toward the end, Daniel was arrested, sent to various concentration camps, and executed at Majdanek. When he was Pastor Edward Thais, whose picture you saw, was asked, "Didn't you ever hate these Germans for that, what they were doing to the parents of these children?" He said, "No, not really, no. You see, we weren't only trying to save the children, we were trying to keep the Germans from staining their lives with more evil." I talked about waiting and seeing. Here in this area, people supported by ministers who had no desire to build cathedrals or careers or chalk up converts. Here in this area, no one ever tried to convert a Jew to Christianity, and no one was converted. Not only were Jews sheltered in this Christian community, Judaism itself was sheltered here. These people simply wanted to be a presence in the darkness that sought to destroy the other. They provided a small piece of breathing room for those whose breath was to be extinguished. In the waiting, they saw people who were different, aliens, but not different from themselves, simply people. As Andre Trocmé said when ordered to turn over the names of Jews in his parish, "These people came here for help and shelter. I am their shepherd. A shepherd cannot forsake his flock. We do not see Jews, we see only human beings." Interesting to think of presidential debates and conversation about immigrants, isn't it? In awaiting through a difficult and risk-filled time, the Chambonnais, the people of Les Chambon and the area surrounding them, saw what needed to be done. They saw in the midst of waiting, and they did it. All of them later, when someone would comment on how good they had been at those comments, "We did nothing especially good. We just did what needed to be done. It happened so naturally that they didn't understand the fuss." Many of these people, by the way, individuals in that community and the entire community, are honored at the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in Israel as the righteous among the nations. Wait and see. The refugees, children whose parents had been taken off to concentration camps, adults simply wanting to find safety, waiting and fearful. Those who were refugees saw people just being what people should be, like a presence rocking in the darkness until a new dawn came. The frightened refugees saw a whole community of people leaning toward them in their quiet way and by their actions saying to them the words Meg Woodson's suffering daughter had heard, "Know deep down you're worth any trouble you cause. Waiting and seeing." In May, Jane and I went to Les Chambon. Jane had asked if I wanted to go to France again, Paris again. I asked if we might be able to go to Les Chambon. I wanted to stand in a place where the whole community showed that it was possible to do the right thing. I wanted to breathe the air of a place where people just naturally act for the good of the other, with no debate, No big organizational structure, no heroic savior, just ordinary people. People like those you'll see in these photographs. Students, Jewish students. Henri and Emma Hertier. When the Free French 1st Armored Division liberated the Vivarais Plateau in September 2nd and 3rd of 1944, the people of Les Chambons were free. But then these people had never ceased to act as free human beings.